They can only say to people who approach them, look at the world with all its horrible comedies and sufferings, due to human ignorance. People are selfish because they erroneously think that selfishness is necessary for their happiness. All this erroneous seeking of happiness at the expense of suffering inflicted on others leads only to so much anguish and pain that if you could hear at this moment all the cries of agony in the universe, you would not be able to stand it. It would sound so heartrending. And you, my friend, who know all this, can you stand aside and do nothing? Don't alleviate symptoms, but go right to the cause. Change your heart, and when your heart is changed, you will live your own teaching and influence the world by your living example. The genuine hermits thus declare that the impulse to change one's life must come from within. It is wrong to use outward practices to become holy. The latter can only lead to short moments of artificially maintained holiness, which provides an excuse for continued heartlessness. Do you care for money or other possessions? One of the genuine hermits was asked once in my presence. No, he replied. Why? I have all I want. But how do you get it? Life itself gives to me all that I want. But why does life not give all they want to others? There are so many people who are hungry and crave a little food. There are people who badly need money, and yet life does not give it to them. Life is just, my friend, the hermit returned. If life does not give you something, life knows that you would misuse it or that you need suffering for the moment. The greatest catastrophe that could come to most people would be the instant satisfaction of all their desires, because they desire things for their little selves, and not for life as a whole. Real hermits of Tibet eat very little. Yet they declare that they never make an effort to abstain from food. They say they do not fast merely because they expect to get something for fasting in the form of a material or spiritual reward. They seem to be so spiritual from within that they are seldom hungry. One day I bluntly asked a Tibetan hermit how he had learned to read people's thoughts. I never began to make an effort to pry into other people's thoughts, he answered. It all came on by itself. I broke down my self-centeredness, and when I reached from within into a state of consciousness which would never permit me to take advantage of my capacity to read other people's thoughts, I could read them. But I never developed this faculty by exercises of one kind or another. Many people would like to be able to read other people's thoughts, I remarked. Yes, he replied, and if egocentrical people could penetrate into the private thoughts of others, the world would become still more terrible than it is at present. It could be like living in a city where all the walls and partitions in the houses were made of glass. This would only be possible in a world where people were unselfish even to the point of voluntarily abstaining from taking an idle interest in other people's affairs. I sometimes feel people's thoughts myself, I told the hermit, and I know it is no pleasant feeling. If thought reading stimulates sympathy with the troubles of others, it is all right, he replied, but woe if it merely stimulates contempt. And where thought reading is developed by outer practices, it usually leads to the latter. If thought reading comes to you from within because you love others so deeply that you feel one with them, it leads to the former, and then there is no danger that you will use this faculty for selfish purposes. And mind, he added, the word selfish is used here in the widest sense. Even if that faculty was used only for self-protection and self-defense, it would be wrong. Superphysical faculties must not be used for physical purposes. That would be a crime. The greater a man's power and understanding in the spiritual realm, the greater his responsibilities. As his powers increase, there must be a corresponding increase in love and compassion, and the latter must come spontaneously from within. The sex life of the Tibetan hermits bears the stamp of abstemiousness. Many of them do not seem to have any sex life at all. Other hermits seem to have reduced indulgence to an incredibly low minimum, corresponding, as one of them told me, to the number of contacts of an animal living in perfect freedom, viz. About twice a year. The highest form of cosmical energy used by a great poet or great composer for creating things bearing the stamp of the eternal is essentially the same energy as the one used in sex matters. A real saint employs his creative energies in such a way that they are used creatively, thus leaving little or nothing for sexual use. But the false saint does not direct these forces correctly. Not being creative, he has a strong sexual appetite, the phenomena of which he regards as temptation, and accordingly he works hard to suppress them out of fear and selfishness. Real Tibetan saints are moral because they want to be moral, and their non-indulgence is natural and effortless. But the virtue of the so-called saints is strained and artificial. They are virtuous because their so-called virtue gives them advantages, be they only advantages of a subtle kind, such as of imagining themselves seated on a kind of throne and looking down on the sinner, which may give them, if I may say so, some sort of perverse enjoyment compensating them for their virtue. There is a distinct difference between the natural and effortless abstemiousness of a real saint and the artificially subdued sensuality of a so-called saint who is holy for selfish reasons. The number of real saints is infinitely smaller than the number of the latter. In some of the Tibetan monasteries, the monks are made to wear cleverly designed appliances destined to cripple certain parts of their body and to force them to be moral by depriving them of the physical possibility of being immoral. Such holiness is of course grotesque, but many other types of enforced holiness, brought about by fear and constraint, really amount to the same thing, although less brutal in appearance. How light and shade are interwoven, and how difficult it is to see realities through the illusion of appearance. An action may have exactly the same aspect, fast, non-indulgence, kindness, etc., and yet the most important thing about it, the motive, may be different. Very often a brutal and a saintly act have precisely the same physical aspect. And yet so many people who call themselves spiritual do not hesitate to judge other people's actions. The real Tibetan hermits do not judge others, but the false saints never miss a chance to do so. This judging of other people's actions is an excellent touchstone of real and false spirituality. How do many people who call themselves spiritual pass this test? In a book which is so often read and yet so seldom applied in the little things of our daily lives, it has written, "Do not judge." We do not know the most important thing about other people's actions, their motives. So don't let us judge others. Let us judge ourselves. We do know the motives of our own actions, and this judging is very necessary and useful. It is stupid to condemn others. Most bad actions are due to ignorance and not to actual malice. If the world is not better than it is our own fault because we have not influenced it sufficiently by example. A man's example is more important than his teaching. We must live our own teaching. This is an utterance giving in a few words the attitude of the real Tibetan hermits. Regarding the hermits, link to Rampa's book, The Hermit. He was a Tibetan Lama's dash into England in 1949. The real hermits have very few actual pupils, and in some cases none at all, but the so-called hermits never can have pupils enough. The latter insist on elaborate ceremonies and solemn greetings whenever they are approached by their pupils. They like to emphasize their dignity and authority by outward marks of respect. The real hermits make light of everything that is strained or artificial. And yet their attitude is commanding. It bears the stamp of the effortless majesty of those who are really great, who do not care what they look like, but only what they are. It is said sometimes that no one is great in the eyes of his valet. Well, I wonder what pitiful sort of greatness such a saying must imply. The more one knows the real Tibetan hermits in the little things of their daily lives, the more one respects them. It is the type of respect that is well deserved and not merely demanded. The authority of the false hermits is elaborately maintained. They calculate the effect of everything they are doing. The real hermits do not do this. The former often teach their pupils how they can remain warm when sitting out in the bitterly cold Tibetan night. They teach them outward practices to accomplish this end. The resistance of Tibetan hermits to the effects of cold is remarkable. Although sometimes they are practically naked, and even if they wear clothes, they are not made of wool, I never saw a fire in their abodes. Even in summer, the Tibetan nights are bitterly cold, the temperature falling below freezing point. I have seen them sit motionless for many hours in bitterly cold weather. They do not seem to suffer in the least from the effects of cold, and one may examine their bodies in vain for any visible traces of exposure to cold weather. Why do they not freeze to death? What is the secret of their perfect resistance to cold? I often slept in an unheated tent at extremely low temperatures and know by experience that one suffers less from the effects of extremely cold weather when one is relaxed. I often go about in Lapland without putting on a hat at temperatures ranging from 20 to 30 degrees centigrade under zero, without showing any signs of exposure to cold afterwards. Relaxation seems to be the essential thing to acquire immunity from the effects of cold. However, it is impossible to teach anybody by exercises how to bring about safely a state of absolute relaxation, for a state of physical relaxation must be the result of a state of psychical relaxation. The less one takes an egocentrical view of life, the less one divides everything in life into the I and the non-I, the more one is relaxed psychically, and then physical relaxation automatically follows. The more egocentrical we are, the more we keep soul and body in a state of tension. If we take life in terms of having instead of in terms of being, the perpetual state of wanting to gain something puts us into a state of cramp, both psychically and physically. The real Tibetan saints do not want to have anything. They take life in terms of being, not in terms of having. If you watch a beautiful sunset or listen to wonderful music and entirely forget that you are Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, you do not desire anything for Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, and in those moments you feel the bliss of the impersonal. You do not want to have the sunset for yourself and deprive others of it. You do not want to possess that beautiful music, and yet you feel happy and know the bliss of absolute unselfishness which seeks no reward whatever for being unselfish. That is real spirituality. And if you hold on to that conception of life, even during the turmoils and hardships of everyday life, you live the life of the real saints, those simple and really human beings with whom religion is a living thing, and not merely lip service or theory. The remarkable resistance to cold of the real saints of Tibet, therefore, is a consequence of a perfect psychical and physical relaxation due to their non-egocentrical conception of life. And how about the others, the so-called saints? They know that cold weather has no grip on the real saints and try to ape them, as they know that it is advantageous to conquer the effects of cold in order to impress others with their powers. They therefore endeavor to bring about a state of relaxation by certain practices coupled with psychical exertions. In both cases the result is quite extraordinary, and the mastery over the effects of cold is complete. Dangerous as the practices of the so-called saints are to the Tibetans, they are all the more dangerous for Westerners, whose nervous system is much more likely to be wrecked by them than the Tibetans. The nervous system of the Tibetans has, no doubt, acquired a certain resistance to the harmful effects of these practices, since these things have been practiced for generations. The nervous system of the white man is much more exposed to them by the absence of this gradual hereditary adaptation. Moreover, the strenuous life of the West puts in itself a very heavy burden on the nervous resistance of the white man, who would be very ill advised to expose himself to an additional terrible strain on his nerves. I do not doubt that any egocentrical white person trying to carry out these practices would sooner or later destroy himself, and as to the few non-egocentrical people, there is no need for them to practice at all. The real saints seem to be able to master the forces of nature, although they never make a show of possessing these powers. They would never make a demonstration of them simply for the purpose of convincing the skeptical, or in order to satisfy mere curiosity. Moreover, I have good reasons to believe that they would not even use these powers in self-defense. Also, their faculty of perfect penetration of other people's thoughts, of which I had evidence again and again when coming into contact with them in Tibet, is never made use of by them for selfish purposes, and when I say so I give the word selfishness its widest possible meaning. I do not doubt that had the false saints possessed the faculty of reading my thoughts, they would not have hesitated a moment to give me away to the lamas. These false saints manage sometimes to rule over the forces of nature to a slight degree. But in nearly all cases the work done for this purpose is so harmful to them and exhausts them so terribly that they work their miracles as seldom as possible. And whenever they have a chance to do so, they replace them by some cleverly staged music hall trick. There are, undoubtedly, some genuine psychical phenomena in Tibet, but they are few and far between, and a tremendous number of alleged cases of phenomena have to be examined before a genuine one, which baffles the most skeptical observer, can be discovered. People who imagine that the flying lamas are numerous in Tibet are mistaken. On an average, one must keep one's eyes wide open for many weeks before one meets even one flying lama, and then the phenomenon usually is far too rapid to permit of lengthy observation. I saw flying lamas only on two occasions. The nearest distance between the Lungampa and myself was about 40 yards on one occasion and only 8 to 10 yards on the other. In both cases the phenomenon presented almost the same aspect. The hands and feet of the lamas swung to and fro like a pendulum. The speed at which they progressed was amazing, and in the case in which the lama was only about 10 yards distant, the glimpse I got of him was sufficient to enable me to ascertain that he was not out of breath. I had the impression that he was in a state of trance, his face looking somewhat like the face of one of the genuine Western mediums. Probably we only have about 30 good mediums in Europe and America put together. But I could not help feeling that the lama was more positive and conscious in his state of trance than our Western mediums. Judging by careful examination of the footprints, the weight of his body must have been diminished to some extent, although I should not like to give an estimate. My camera had been destroyed by robbers, and even had I still been able to use it, the light would not have been good enough to have taken a photograph of a person moving at a speed of at least 15 miles an hour. On the second occasion on which I met a flying lama, the light was good for taking a snapshot at about 1/200 of a second, but I was not alone to watch the phenomenon, so even had my camera still been good enough for use, it would have been impossible to have taken a photograph without arousing the curiosity and suspicion of the Tibetans. I had no occasion to regret the destruction of my camera, anyhow. Because I know by actual experience that photographic evidence of psychical phenomena is very seldom of much use. Many years ago I took a delight in securing genuine ghost pictures taken at seances in the West. I then made an equal number of fake ghost pictures by taking 3 or 4 photographs on the same plate. My next action was to mix the 2 sets of ghost photographs, which I handed to people who had had great practical experience in judging psychical phenomena, requesting them to find the genuine ghost photograph amongst the faked ones. They failed miserably. They pronounced many faked photographs to be genuine, and pronounced about just as many genuine ghost pictures to be faked ones. The testing of psychical phenomena by suitable apparatus is a much more reliable way of ascertaining their reality. The explorer traveling in disguise is handicapped by the impossibility of using instruments designed for the purpose of psychical research. I have given lectures on the psychical phenomena of Tibet for the members of various societies of psychical research in Scandinavia, Holland, and other countries, and after my lectures I was always willing to answer questions about the minutest details of my experiences in Tibet. Nevertheless, when the facts about psychical phenomena are presented for examination, we must not lose sight of the fact that even in Western countries, where considerable facilities exist for carrying out research work of this kind, the greatest brains of this age are still at variance as to whether the evidence concerning the reality of psychical phenomena shall be admitted or not. Personally, I am inclined to believe that if an individual concentrates all his willpower and energies, during a period of say 20 years, on the task of producing a particular occult phenomenon, such as levitating himself a few feet into the air, he may succeed, although he may have to pay dearly for the accomplishment by gradually ruining his health and nervous balance. But in order to bring about such a result, I do not think that, say, half an hour's work per day during 20 years will be sufficient. He must really concentrate all his energies, all his willpower, and all his time to that end. And if a person who happens to be self-centered finally succeeds in going up into the air, I think the ultimate punishment for this selfish dabbling in occultism will be self-destruction. The dark occultists of Tibet, viz. People who engage themselves in the dangerous practice of using occult powers for selfish purposes, inspire the Tibetans with fear and horror. The most powerful of them are supposed by the Tibetans to possess the dark power to kill people at a distance of many hundred yards, by sending them a kind of subtle invisible arrow made of the fine substance of which the subtle invisible body, see Chapter 5, consists. This may, of course, be gross exaggeration, but it seems to be beyond doubt that these men can work harm if they choose to do so. However, they must be very careful in the choice of their victims, for it is a fact recognized by all occultists that an absolutely unselfish and fearless man cannot be hurt by adverse influences, and that any hostile influence destined to work harm to him automatically bounces back and injures the person trying to harm him. He would act like a man throwing a ball against a wall for the purpose of damaging it, and receiving it back on his nose. Some of the false saints of Tibet succeed in developing clairvoyance and clairaudience to a very slight degree, but the real hermits possess these powers in an extraordinary way. Fairly often I passed false saints in Tibet, none of whom ever knew the fact that I was not a Tibetan. On two or three occasions only they seemed to feel vaguely that there was something unusual about me. The belief in the existence of the aura, the invisible cloud surrounding our dense physical bodies, is fairly general in Tibet. The aura is said to be visible only to clairvoyants. Visible is not the right term though. The clairvoyant senses the aura. In most cases he does not see it, but perceives it with his or her whole ethereal body. It is difficult to transcribe the experiences of a clairvoyant into a language made for describing physical things. Supposing a normal person tried to describe to an audience of blind people what yellow, red, or blue alike. His description would be just as inadequate as the terms used by a clairvoyant in describing a thing his audience had never experienced. It is, naturally, simple to dispose of the whole problem of clairvoyance by declaring that it is all humbug. I do not think such a simple and convenient way of dealing with unwelcome facts is justified, for sometimes when a person visits various clairvoyants who do not know each other and who live in different districts, they will give descriptions of his aura which tally closely. There are genuine clairvoyants in Tibet, but they do not seem to be very numerous. False clairvoyants, on the other hand, abound. Every Lama of high rank, for instance, is credited with the power of clairvoyance, and most of the older Lamas try to make people believe that they are clairvoyants, in order to heighten their authority. When coming in contact with the type of individual in Tibet who feels that he absolutely needs a miracle in order to facilitate his spiritual business, explorers must be on their guard. There are cases where Tibetan sorcerers do not seem to hesitate to use hypnotic powers in order to make their audience see things which do not exist. Great care also from this angle is necessary, therefore, in judging alleged Tibetan miracles. Whenever possible, material traces, be they ever so slight, should be examined after a phenomenon has taken place. The author avoided mixing in with a crowd when studying such phenomena wherever, of course, this was possible without attracting attention. Even if there may be no conscious hypnotic influence present, it is not a good thing to mix with crowds. People anxious to maintain an independent and objective attitude should give them a wide berth. However, even if all these reserves and exceptions to the reality of Tibetan phenomena are taken into consideration, the absolute reality of thought transmission over fairly long distances and certain other less striking phenomena, such as psychometry and the like, is unquestionable. Many of my readers will be surprised to learn that sometimes phenomena which can be produced at an altitude of 10,000 feet do not come off at an altitude of 13,000 feet. There are phenomena which can be produced in clear weather only, and a subsequent change in weather conditions entirely paralyzes the sorcerer. Does not this go to show that these miracles are subject to well-established laws of nature, and that there is nothing really miraculous about them? In one instance it was quite obvious that psychometrical faculties were greatly disturbed by rainy weather. I had wrapped up various small items in a cloth and showed the parcel to a Tibetan reputed for his powers of psychometry. He could always tell me, at least approximately, what the cloth contained without opening the parcel. On one occasion I had placed an animal's tooth within it. When I asked him to tell me what was hidden there, his answer was, "Something that hurts one." His answer was correct, although not correct to the letter. Many answers are similarly vague. A subsequent change in the weather paralyzed his psychometrical faculty entirely, and he did not regain it until the weather had changed back again. Even under the most favorable conditions, the judging of psychical phenomena is a difficult matter. Answers are often only nearly right. Furthermore, the fact that someone watches the phenomenon with hostile skepticism may paralyze the whole affair, and nothing will happen. Many people judge psychical phenomena like a judge who has his sentence ready before a trial. They watch phenomena with the judgment humbug already well established in their minds. As a well-known scientist once told me, they do not wish to admit a thing which they fail to understand. Skepticism is a very good and necessary thing when judging psychical phenomena, but hostile skepticism goes much too far. Not only some of the so-called hermits in Tibet occasionally produce miracles, in quite exceptional cases, apparently genuine ones, in most cases faked ones, but also, some of the lamas in the monasteries. Especially with the latter, the few seemingly genuine phenomena are literally swamped with an enormous quantity of music hall tricks, and sometimes the grossest types of fraud. There is a venerable priest, for instance, who makes his pupils go about announcing that he can go up into the air at will by reducing to naught the weight of his venerable body. Many, hundreds of enthusiasts go every day to watch the phenomenon. Is it not nice and refreshing to see a holy man go up several times into the air and come back to the ground immediately afterwards? The curious crowds, worked up into a state of pious sheepishness, gather round a carefully closed cell. They cannot see what is going on within, but from time to time they hear the impact of a human body falling back to the ground. In the eyes of the Tibetan crowd, this is conclusive evidence of the reality of the phenomenon. They believe in the miracle, and afterwards are as generous as possible in their contributions towards the living expenses of the Lama and his pupils. Their childlike credulity is, perhaps, coupled with a certain amount of fear of so powerful a man, to whom even the forces of nature are assumed to render obedience. A civilized Westerner may smile at this. But too often Westerners, when they are crowded together, are not more critical than Tibetan crowds. 7. In some cases the Tibetan priests do not hesitate to eke out their incomes by selling miracle shoes alleged to carry the person wearing them over rivers and lakes, by preventing them from sinking. These shoes are like ordinary Tibetan felt shoes, but with one difference: they are exceedingly expensive. Intending buyers are informed that the sale of the shoes is subject to two conditions. Firstly, the purchase price has to be paid before the shoes are tried, and secondly, the miracle shoes must be tested alone, in the absence of witnesses. Just when a Lama happened to be selling miracle shoes to a crowd of credulous Tibetans, 5 or 6 people, who had bought miracle shoes a few hours earlier, returned, in order to protest, as they had found the shoes useless. They had tried to walk on the surface of water with disastrous results. "Rinpoche," said one of them to the Lama in the presence of the crowd, "you sold me this pair of miracle shoes, and Jay carefully complied with your instructions. I paid the price in advance and no one else was present when I tried them. And now I come back to protest," he continued, "as the shoes failed to work and are of no use at all." One should have expected the pious Lama to be greatly embarrassed on hearing this protest in the presence of a large crowd, but he was quite unperturbed. "Holy Father, did you really sink in, friend?" he asked mildly. "Yes," replied the Tibetan, "and I was nearly drowned. I went down in the water as quickly as a person wearing ordinary shoes." A murmur went through the crowd. The Lama raised his voice. "I shall tell you why these shoes are of no use to you," he said. The miracle shoes are holy, and if sinners wear them, they lose their magical powers. I always walk with them on the surface of rivers and lakes if no witnesses are present, and if another person who is not too bad a sinner complies with my instructions and tries them out alone, they always work. The Tibetan was greatly humiliated on being called a bad sinner in the presence of the large crowd, and the Lama went on, speaking louder and louder, presenting the poor chap to the crowd as a living example of a man leading a sinful life.